Today's program was brought to you by craftbeer.com, dedicated to small and independent U.S. craft brewers. For more information, visit craftbeer.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Why Food with me, your host, Patrick McAndrew. Each week I'm joined by a new guest who has made the transition from a previous career into the food industry. The show is here to share inspiring stories of people who have restarted their careers and followed their passions. And this season we're taking a look at the depth of the industry with each guest representing a different career. This episode is the first of two covering the life of the restaurateur. Adam Eskin is today's guest. He's the founder of Dig In, a seasonal restaurant serving farm-to-table fare with 15 restaurants based in the New York and Boston area. But before Dig In, Adam worked in investment banking. Good afternoon and welcome to episode 16 of Why Food. I'm here with Adam Eskin at the headquarters of Dig In. Thanks very much for having me here today, Adam.
Pleasure, thanks for coming.
Yeah, it's a beautiful view, it's a beautiful day, nice blue skies.
It is, right?
How long have you guys been based out of here?
This is relatively new for us, actually.
Yeah.
We moved in end of December, early January. So just a couple of months here. We were over on 27th Street for a number of years, but ultimately ran out of space.
Yeah, I can imagine, because how many is it? 16 restaurants at the moment?
We just opened number 15.
You just opened number 15?
Yep. And we've got 16 and 17 under construction, and so we're moving along.
With that, the team just builds up sort of very, very quickly.
Yeah. It's well, some of them take a little bit longer than others. But I think the next one is slated to open up in Boston in mid-May.
Yeah, how's that been for you guys? Because it's been focused in New York so much since you opened up.
Boston's been a great community for us. It's my hometown, so that's been a lot of fun. Yep, grew up on the South Shore, halfway between Boston and Cape Cod. So it's always nice to, bring your life's work home with you and see how folks respond. So Boston's been great. We opened our first this past July in the back bay on Boylston Street, right on Copley Square. Wonderful location. Got the farmer's market right out front a couple times a week. You know, the community's been great in terms of our guests and just being responsive and excited about what we do. You know, it seems that we've filled a bit of an unmet need up there, which feels great. And the agriculture and the farming community up there, a lot of folks we already had, relationships with, going up and down the East Coast, but they've been incredibly supportive as well. So it was a great, really great experience for us leaving the city for the first time, opening in our first market outside of New York, my hometown. Couldn't be happier.
Cool. So let's go back to that. Let's go back to the start. So you grew up in Boston.
I did.
When you grew up, now we have Dig In, which is a place with farm-to-table food, amazing access to amazing ingredients. You're serving, you said there was a need for it in Boston. There was definitely a need for it in New York when you guys opened up.
But sure.
Was that something that was always of interest to you, to be in the world of food, or something that played an important role in your life?
Yeah, not necessarily. Wasn't necessarily my plan to get into food, or frankly, to do something entrepreneurial. I would say a good food, and I would put that in quotes if we were, not on radio here. The definition of good food has changed pretty dramatically. It's evolved quite a bit, over the last couple of decades. We've learned more, right? We're all just getting a bit more educated, whether it's the books that we're reading, Michael Pollan, Alice Waters, the movies that we're watching, and just generally sort of the cultural movement, around what it means to eat good food and how do we define good food. We went through this period of several decades where it was much more about fad diets than it was about putting good whole ingredients into your body. Certainly, the advent of Whole Foods in the early 80s, has helped us, a number of things have brought us along. Even the work, frankly, that Chipotle did, in sort of the early days of fast casual and the whole assembly line experience and committing to high quality ingredients, classical cooking techniques in an environment that was accessible from a price point perspective, from a speed perspective, and from a scale perspective. So there was a period of time where growing up, I was actually a little bit delayed, went through a pretty late growth spurt, so I was shorter and a little chubby. So I got into fitness and got into eating well, you know, relatively speaking, right? So, you know, there was a pretty extreme period that I went through, which was, you know, eating out of the cans of tuna fish cans. And
yeah, I was just going to say, was that like the protein craze?
Protein craze, steamed broccoli, you know, like I'd slide the mashed potatoes off my plate. So I went through that whole thing, was into fitness. Then I finally grew, you know, and then sort of went through puberty and all those things. And the fitness and the eating well and the taking out of my body sort of stuck with me. So that was a common thread. Ultimately, I got into the investment business. I worked on Wall Street in Merrill Lynch as an investment banker. Went from there to a private equity firm based in Connecticut and spent some time there.
And just to talk about that then, because you went to Brown to do economics, right?
I did.
So when you went there to go to college as a young guy, what drew you towards finance? Why did you want to go into working that?
I guess I was always pretty linear and pragmatic. So more born out of ignorance than anything else in terms of I thought, you know, I grew up, was very fortunate, you know, great parents, great family, very middle class, you know, dad was in sales, mother was in education, she was a teacher for 35 years, so we never went without, but it's not like we lived in excess either. And so I felt, you know, I was given some things that I was fortunate to have in terms of some modest success with academics and thought, you know, it was my opportunity to, you know, sort of walk up the ladder of life and maybe, you know, at some point change the trajectory of, you know, the Eskin lineage, you know, financially and otherwise. So not knowing much of anything, it seemed like folks that went to Wall Street did well, right, and provided for their families and, you know, went on nice vacations. And so it was a very pragmatic thought process. And so business economics seemed like a good place to start.
It's the ultimate dream when you're a young man if you want to get success.
You know?
Get the suit on.
And then after freshman year, it seemed like you could do more with, you know, the education that my parents were slaving away to pay for. And so I started taking computer science sophomore year and added that to my curriculum. And it's funny looking back because those were the years the folks that I went to school with that were in the same computer science classes. You know, the folks that went on to take leadership roles in Google and Facebook and really change the world. I totally missed that boat, you know? Like, they were all paying attention. Clearly, I was not. And so, for me, it was just a really exciting opportunity to learn how to write code, problem solve, work on teams. So, I just found it really stimulating. But stayed the course with finance. Started at Merrill as a summer analyst and then got an offer to come back full-time and thought that was, you know, just another sort of rung on the ladder, you know, get high marks, get into a good school, go into finance and, you know, sort of create, you know, opportunities for yourself. So that was the thinking. I wasn't particularly passionate about investment banking or financial services.
Yeah, that's the thing I'm so curious to hear because with the show, you know, the basis of the show being Why Food, there's so many people who've been in corporate jobs and they strive to get there and they work so hard in college to get there and there's a status associated to it, you know, obviously it pays you very well. But during those times when you're there, what are you thinking? Because, you know, you're seeing the money going into your account and you're getting well paid and you know that the opportunities to do well are there. But in the back of your mind, are you thinking, I wish I could drop all of this and, you know, go to something more creative or something that I'm in more control of?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly moments, and I've heard use these words, and I've certainly heard them from a number of my comrades. It's a little soul crushing at times, you know. Part of it is, you know, the work that you're doing. You know, some folks find it incredibly stimulating, you know, and they find a career and a place there, and no judgment. But others, myself included, do not. And so for me, it was really more of a means to an end, you know, which was part education. I will say you go there and you're in that environment and you're working 80, 90, 100 hours a week. You know, you're working on financial models and putting together presentations and you learn a lot about yourself. You know, how far you can push yourself, how hard you can work. You know, sort of your relative endurance professionally. You learn things like attention to detail. You know, the footnote on page 5. If it's a half font size off, you know, the person you're reporting to usually noticed and made it clear that should be caught next time, right? So it was a great learning experience. And if I were to do it over again, I probably would do it, you know, over again. You learn a lot about business, and the financial side of business. And why that matters, right? Still believe to this day that, you know, business that's truly sustainable actually makes money, right? And supports itself. So I think it was a great foundation for me,
right?
But not something that I wanted to pursue long term.
So if we skip forward, then I think would it have been 3 or 4 years later after you started off in the finance world, you got the portfolio for The Pump, which was a group of, was it 4 restaurants?
It was 5.
5.
Yeah. So while I was working, when I left Maryland and I started working for the private equity firm, I did have an opportunity to work on what was our first and only at the time restaurant deal. It was a bankruptcy process deal where we bought the bonds, took ownership of the business, and then spent a bunch of years trying to turn it around. So I was staffed on it with a partner. It was a California, San Diego-based company, so we flew out once a month for 3 or 4 days, sat with the management team, and so that was also a really great learning experience. So other than bussing tables in high school, you know, that was really sort of my first opportunity to get exposed to the business of restaurants. So I spent about half my time while I was there on that deal, and we ultimately exited that business in, you know, sort of 05 heading into 06. And we thought, well, we learned a lot. You know, we didn't make a bunch of money on this deal, but we learned a lot about the restaurant business, good, bad, or otherwise.
And when you're overseeing it, are you overseeing, like, where the money is being made, where it's not being made, where the downfalls were?
The context for this was, you know, when you have a business that's broken, you know, it's more about what you don't do than what you do do, right? So we just tried to bring a level of sort of just basic business sense and blocking and tackling to the business, you know? So if you're going to change a menu, why don't you test it first and ask your customers, do they like the menu, you know, before you go and change it? You know, just really, really basic blocking and tackling. You know, there's certainly the financial side, which is sort of managing the cash and putting some processes and tools in place that you can really understand day to day, week to week, you know, what does the financial health of the business look like? But on the strategic, how do we turn this business around operationally? It was bringing new people in, you know, and like working alongside them to make, you know, some smart decisions, but mostly avoiding making those decisions that would have sort of been to the detriment to the business.
So how did The Pump transition to Dig In then?
Well, so the story goes that, so I spent a bunch of time on that deal, and then we were looking to go and sort of redeploy what we call intellectual capital, right? So we spent a bunch, I don't know, all told, because they got into the business before I started. I mean, 6 or 8 years we spent on that particular deal. So when we finally sold it, we thought, hey, we've learned a few things. You know, perhaps the restaurant industry is a space that's interesting to us, and perhaps we should continue to pursue opportunities in this space. However, what we were hoping at the time, or at least what we were thinking, was let's, instead of finding something that we have to completely turn around, you know, a 30 or a 40 or a 50 year old legacy brand, you know, let's I try to identify where is the world headed, and how can we invest alongside maybe this new thesis. So we took a step back and said, well, where is the world headed? And when we put together, there's a memo that we wrote, and it basically said what had happened to grocery via Whole Foods was going to happen to the restaurant industry. And interestingly enough, both businesses or industries domestically are about $700 billion businesses, right? So about 1.4 in the aggregate between the two. So Whole Foods was certainly making a dent, right? And they were paving the way on the grocery side. We felt that that was ultimately going to happen in restaurants. Also, when we started to look around and identify opportunities in which to invest, what we realized was nobody had been doing it yet, right? This was back in 05 and 06, and it was still very early.
And one thing at this stage was, it was happening kind of on the underbelly within restaurants, high-end restaurants, where people were getting access to this farm to table movement, but it was so far removed from the normal person because it was expensive tasting menus or going up to Dan Barber, Stone Barns and something like that. But there was nothing on the floor where
Correct.
People had access to go in and pay eventually $10 for a good quality meal.
Correct. So ultimately we found this little business in our backyard, you know, in New York, mom and pop. Founders, you know, a couple of great people, you know, really strong, wonderful, passionate, you know, hardworking. They put a decade, you know, of their lives into this business. We started speaking with them, and ultimately, you know, we glossed over, frankly, a lot of the details, and we just thought, hey, we know restaurants now, and the world is headed in this direction, so we can buy this small business that has a great foundation and a great following, and, you know, quote unquote, we can just clean it up, as they say, and then off we go, right? You know, and I think, you know, when you're sitting in that seat and you know, we didn't have a ton of experience with growth equity. smaller stage businesses, nor did we have a ton of experience with consumer brands, right? So there was a lot that we didn't know, that I didn't know. And we felt, you know, what could be so hard, right? We'll clean it up, turn it around, reposition it, and off we go. And it'll be a nice platform for us. And when we got in there, so we made a small investment and took control of the business. There was an operator that we were working with and talking to that we expected to sort of take lead. He took another opportunity, and that's when the opportunity availed itself for me, you know, where he said, you know what, why don't I parachute in for a year, you know, take control of the business, get it started, and then ultimately we can bring in a team. And in theory, I could stay, I could head back, you know, to Connecticut, take my old job, so on and so forth. So the expectation was, okay, this is a one-year deal. I'm very passionate from a lifestyle perspective about this movement. I participate myself in terms of the lifestyle, how I eat, certainly believe in where the world is headed. All of my peers, brother and sister-in-law, were having young kids, you know, and they're feeding them, you know, Bell and Evans organic chicken, you know, air-chilled chicken fingers, you know. So it seemed to be obvious this is what was happening. When I got there and we got under the hood that first year, we realized maybe we shouldn't have bought this business. There was
really, it was. I was expecting something totally different. No, that you were just going to say, I fell in love, and it just
no. It wasn't like that at all. It was. We didn't know what we didn't know. And once you get under the hood, you know, there's only so much I think you can discover. And I think we could have done a better job, frankly, of trying to understand the nuances and the details of this business from the get go. But we didn't know. We didn't know. We got involved. Got under the hood. And it became clear that this was not a platform necessarily that we could just clean up and grow. And that we really needed to take a step back and say, okay, you know, if we really believe in where this is headed, you know, is this our platform or do we need to reposition it entirely? And ultimately concluded the latter, you know, that while it was great that we acquired the small business and, you know, let's just acknowledge that we made a mistake. With the business that we bought, let's also acknowledge that the macro thesis, you know, remains intact, and in fact, you know, those tailwinds continue to accelerate and sort of blow stronger and blow stronger. And so,
just to give a feel, this was around 2008, was it? 2008, 2009?
Yeah, 2007, 8, 9, 8, 8 into 9.
So
yeah.
Even at the time then, it was when the market was starting, it had taken a huge dip, so it's not as if the gods were on your side.
Well, the world went through an interesting period of time, yeah, which certainly made it more challenging, but also I think further contributed to the education that we've had here, you know, over, you know, it's now been a decade. You know, there's a lot of, you know, as non-linear as our story is, you know, there's a lot that we went through before we even became Dig In that I think has contributed, you know, in a meaningful way to our ability to understand what we do need to do to grow this business successfully. And so while it was happening, I'm reading more books, you know, I'm reading Pollen, I'm reading this and that. And I think that's when, you know, because there's the personal side, you know, do I want to commit my life to being in the restaurant business? It's a hard business, right? Yeah. 24/7, it never stops.
Problems all the time.
Problems all the time. You know, you're in the people business, you're in the real estate business, you're in the logistics business, you're in the perishable food business. There's just a lot, you know, it's a lot to handle. So I was sort of grappling with that question and decision. I had a ton of conviction around this idea that this is where the world was headed and this was an unmet need and that this is something that we could do that didn't exist. But you question yourself, right? Because you're not really sure, and what you're doing every day is not working so well, right? So there were a few periods of transition for me, but I was ultimately really committed to what I thought it could be long term, and sort of the need and sort of the place that this business would have in the world. So we hired various people with different backgrounds that knew a lot more about the restaurant business and the industry than I did. Got a lot of help along the way, different mentors, just sort of a lot of folks contributing to ultimately what we've become. And, you know, so we tore the business down and we kind of restarted with a sort of new age, quote unquote, fast casual model. And we started to make progress. We were working on operations, we were working on the menu, we were working on the food. And on a monthly basis, we were just trying to get better this month than the last month.
Right.
Had a lot of great people along the way that were really scrappy, you know, and were willing to do the hard work alongside me.
That's how you described yourselves for many years, as a scrappy startup.
We're still that way, you know, as we transition and build things like a new office, more of a leadership team, we start to scale the business, head into new markets. There's a number of, I think, attributes associated with our company culture and our brand that we do not want to lose.
There's a great sense of humility, because when I started looking at Dig In, we're in 2017, it would have been 2015, and you had probably 9 restaurants at that stage, I think, in 2015 when I came here.
Sounds right, yep.
And you were still calling yourself a scrappy startup, so that's a great sense of humility to have 9 restaurants under your belt and still kind of say, we haven't made it yet, we still have a long, long way to go.
We do, it's almost a fact. And I also just think it's important, you know, again, culturally, you know, that some of the things that we've done have allowed us to get to the place that we've gotten to, and I think it's really, really, really dicey, even as you grow and you scale and you grow the size of the organization, to the extent that you lose, sort of, or, you know, choose not to continue to embrace some of those values and those beliefs that have gotten you there, I think that's when companies and brands and culture start to get into trouble.
One thing that I'm really interested in, because, you know, the benefit of your background being in finance and the benefit of your connections with finance companies was that you got funding. And when you get funding from companies like this, do they have a say in it, or is it still totally with you that you have full control of it, of the vision for the company?
Sure.
And where it's going?
Look, everyone's circumstances are different. What ended up happening with us was, you know, as we were scrapping through it, you know, the sort of interstitial couple of years, you know, really trying to find our way, really trying to find what ultimately, you know, became Dig In, you know, this sort of mission-driven, really focused company. You know, we actually ultimately, myself and my erstwhile employer, we said, look, you know, we have a different vision. You know, I really believe in where we're going and what we're doing. The numbers don't show it yet, but we need more time. You know, they're successful because they're in the business of making sound investments, right? And being decisive. So we made a decision back in 2010 and 2011, not to part ways entirely, but it was a business that group controlled and was still very close to them to this day, and they're still partners of ours. We made a decision where we would transition control to me, and then rather than continue to get funding from the group, that I would go out and raise my own capital. And so I did what was called a friends and family rounds, right? Went out to a bunch of friends, colleagues, a handful of customers, you know, that were coming every day and sort of could see what we saw, and it really, even at that point, really enjoyed what we were doing. So we put together a small round of financing, and that's what really sort of paved the way, you know, for sort of the launch pad of Dig In, you know. So at that point, we said, look, we've made a lot of progress, but, you know, for us to really sort of fulfill our dream and make this business and brand. That's my dog, Max.
We've got a dog in the room.
We do have a dog in the room. We're going to try and get him to be quiet. You know, that's when things really started to accelerate. That's when we developed the brand. You know, that's when we sort of launched Dig In officially. And you know, that's when I think we really got serious about what this could be. And it was frightening because, although I believed in it, didn't really know how it was going to pan out. And again, the numbers at the time were not suggesting necessarily, you know, that our future was bright.
Well, that's what I want to get into after the break. We're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the incredible ascent of Dig In from that moment onward.
Right on. Cool. Looking forward to it.
Do you love craft beer? The diversity of styles and flavors? The stories of small brewery businesses and the communities behind today's craft beer movement? If so, you'll love craftbeer.com, published by the Brewers Association. Whether you tasted your first craft beer 30 years ago or just caught the bug last week, craftbeer.com is the number one destination for beer education, news, and recipes. Looking for a local brewery? Use the internet's most robust brewery finder to discover your new favorite place. Want to get geeky about your favorite beer style or find the perfect pairing for dinner? Craftbeer.com is the leading authority and can help. Celebrate the best of American beer. Visit craftbeer.com today.
Welcome back to the second half of Dig In. I'm here with the CEO and founder, Adam Eskin, of Dig In. And prior to the break, we were just talking about the passage of Dig In to come to where it was. As scrappy as it was described, we're now at the moment where things started to kind of fall into place. You knew who you were, and Dig In was kind of starting to take flight. Actually, this is a great place to start, because this is something that I found very interesting. Dig In's approach on the supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
How early was it where you guys decided the traditional supply chain of getting food from the farmer to the restaurant doesn't work and we need to reevaluate it and make it more efficient?
Yeah. So as we learned a bit more about the restaurant industry, supply chain, distributors, brokers, how that whole equation worked, and then we sort of tried to marry that with our desire to serve super high quality food, you know, grown in the area, shipped in, you know, prepped, cooked, and served, and to do so at a reasonable price in an accessible way. Seemed that there was a disconnect in terms of how the at least on the produce side, the supply chain was set up, right? It's there's not a ton of transparency in produce markets, right? It's not like soybeans or energy where they trade on an exchange.
Right, because right? it can vary on a day-to-day basis.
It can vary on a day-to-day basis. You know, depending on the particular item, there are a number of... It's not homogenous.
Avocados. You know? Avocados are notorious.
Well, avocados is one thing, but right, but you could have, you know, any particular vegetable, take carrots. You know, you have 7 different sizes, different colors. It's not a homogenous product, so it's very, very hard to get visibility. So we found that just the whole food growing agriculture distribution system was just very murky, right? And for us, that in a way meant that there was a lot of built-in costs and a lot of layers that didn't necessarily need to be there. And we also thought about if we were going to be the brand that we wanted to be and serve the mission and the purpose we wanted to serve, we really had to get to know the food and get to know the people that were growing the food, right? So it seemed intuitive for us to figure out how to actually be having a conversation, not with the big distributors that were shipping the food and moving a box from point A to point B, but the folks who were actually growing it, you know? And then over time, as our company grew and we partnered with those smaller and medium-sized farmers, they could grow alongside of us, and those could be really great relationships and really great partnerships. So that's how we started. We brought folks, one in particular, into the organization, didn't have a ton of supply chain experience, but was just, you know, as passionate as they come about what we were trying to accomplish, just young and smart and hungry. So we got to work on it, and I think some of the aspects around how we were thinking about it proved to be true. And it took years and years and years, mostly around relationship building, in addition to figuring out and learning about logistics and supply and, you know, sort of how to partner on an active basis with different logistics platforms to move stuff around and get it into our restaurants. But it's been a pretty big differentiator for us from a business perspective, and I think it's also had a pretty significant impact on the quality of the food that we serve, right? So, you know, when we first started, you know, it was kind of like, you know, fake it till you make it. You know, we know this is what we want to do, you know, and these are things we want to talk about, but we don't quite know how we're going to get there, so we're just going to start. And, you know, 5 or 6 years later, you know, we do have, you know, something that's fairly proprietary that you couldn't just snap your fingers and recreate overnight.
So what does the current system look like?
So I'd say 80% of what we buy, you know, we buy on a direct basis. And then we work with third-party logistics providers. Some of those will be what's called broadline distributors, right? They're in the business of moving food or paper or other things from point A to point B. We also contract with trucking companies directly, you know, for moving trailer loads on our own, you know, back and forth from a farm or a particular area to our supply center in the Bronx. But we have this network. Each season, for the most part, we add to that network, you know. We talk to more folks. We get more redundancy. So kale farmer first year, second year, same kale farmer, but double the volume. Third year, bring in the second kale farmer. By the fourth year, we've got probably 3 or 4 or 5 that we work with. So we've just been building this network. It's been incredibly relationship driven. And I think that's really the foundation upon which it's built, which is there's a lot of trust, there's dialogue. You know, there have been some moments where I've been working with the really small folks. We'll finance a refrigerated truck for them, and we'll bake that into our pricing, or, you know, we'll cut a $5,000 or $10,000 check to cover the cost up front for the seeds and the other materials they need to start planting, right, and getting the season off to a start. So we've been very open and flexible to different ways of supporting, understanding that, you know, sort of, you know, they're the hand that feeds us. And if we do right by them, they'll do right by us.
Yeah, and that expands upon your mission, because your mission isn't just to expand as many restaurants as possible. It goes far beyond that. It's to to try and change the food system in some shape or manner. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I mean, it's one big community, right? From the people that are growing it, that are consuming food and their own food, right, to the folks that are shipping it all the way through to the guests that are walking in our door, right? That's one big, really incredibly valuable and important chain in our world, right? If we're not consuming food, that's problematic. And as we know, over the last 30, 40, 50 years, we've had some challenges with food and with agriculture, and that's resulted in things like obesity and a broken healthcare system, right? So there's just been a lot of systemic fracturing, you know, that we've sort of witnessed over the, since the 40s, 50s, 60s. And so agriculture and food at large is at the center of all those things. And look, there are politics in Washington, there are much bigger issues here, you know, so I think it's going to take decades and decades and decades to flush itself out. But I am I'm a capitalist, I'm a big believer in capitalism. We support and collaborate with the nonprofit sector.
Just to touch on that, does the political climate affect the market for you guys?
The current political climate?
Do you see how there will be a change, a shift from the past administration to this administration with the way, you know, regulations are going to be impacted? Or is it so above your head? Or like,
no, look, I think it's too early to tell. I think a lot of people are standing around waiting, you know, and watching and paying attention. You know, certainly some of the things that have been said, the rhetoric, right, is a little bit frightening, right?
It's not too pleasant, yeah.
Right? It's a little bit frightening. It's a little bit divisive. You know, we've got 500 or 600 people that work for this company, you know? And, you know, there's a number of things, from things like minimum wage laws and a fair wage and how we're paying people. These are not high school students, you know, with 20 hours a week just for fun. These are folks that are coming to work every day to support a family, right? And you can't do that on $8, $9, $10, right? So we feel strongly about that. We feel strongly about the impact that certain discussions around, you know, our relationship with places like Mexico and so forth and agriculture. You can't just make sweeping decisions like that, right? Because there's thousands and thousands of people that we need to come to work every day to support food, you know, the broader system. There are folks that are sort of currently being identified that are at the heart of that. And without them, we're not eating, right? So we find that to be highly problematic. But that also gives us a little bit of comfort in knowing that that is the reality. And we're somewhat hopeful that, you know, some of these things that have been talked about, they're not just going to happen, you know, and then the workforce is going to evaporate, right? Because those dominoes will fall pretty quickly. Politics, more broadly speaking, beyond just the current political climate, you know, you have big food and big agriculture, and they've got, you know, serious resources, and they've been pretty active on the lobbying front in D.C. for a long time, you know, and so unwinding that stuff, you know, then you're getting into things like campaign finance reform, right? And as long as people can win by raising, and people can line pockets, you know, to fundraise, to help win, you know, that's a pretty perverted equation that we have here in this country in terms of how elected officials make their way. So that's why I say, you know, there are certain aspects about the system and how it's set up such that it may take decades, you know, to really, really flush out. But going back to the point that I was trying to make initially, which is I'm a capitalist at heart, and I believe that businesses, consumer-facing businesses, play the role of connecting the voice of the consumer and the desires of the consumer via, you know, the old voting with their wallet, where we, absent politics or any of these other things, right, if we're having an impact and we're doing exciting things that are positive, and we're also building a sustainable business that's profitable, that adds jobs, right, that supports economic growth and agriculture, all those things, we don't need DC or these other things legislatively or otherwise to happen. You know, we can just grow our business, and by virtue of growing our business, you know, if we get to 50 restaurants or we get to 100 restaurants, right, locally, regionally, that's a pretty material impact that we'll have across the board in terms of the food system. And to me, that's real change that we can control.
Yeah, I have no doubt that that'll happen, seeing the trend and what you're going on at the moment.
Thank you.
One thing I want to talk about, which I loved, was when I saw you at the This Has Been conference. And I don't know if this is something that's been a mission the whole way through or if it's just come recently, but your focus on eat more veg.
Yeah.
Was that always there from the start, or is that something that you've come to focus on more recently?
Yeah, I mean, since we've launched Dig In, that's been a focus of ours. You know, we feel like if there's one thing that we can do, we can sum it up in one statement in terms of how to improve the food system, improve our diets, make this place just a little bit healthier. You know, we're big believers in eating the stuff that's grown out of the ground, right? We're big believers in the efficiency of those calories relative to others. We're not vegan or vegetarian, and we also believe that there's a place for sustainably grown or raised animals, right? You know, that are taken care of the right way, and we serve those things too. You know, whether it be chicken or steak, wild salmon or otherwise. You know, it's funny, going back to what we talked about earlier, you know, there's a moment in time or a period of time when I thought I needed to consume 250 calories of protein a day, right? And I was, like, reading, you know, those books and those magazines, and, like, that was the fad back then, right?
Yeah. It still lingers around.
It's not nearly as prevalent, but it's just not true, you know? I'm living and breathing. I could go multiple days without eating animal protein, and it just doesn't move the needle. For me, personally, ultimately, if I go long enough, I can feel it, you know, and I need to eat some chicken or some fish or some steak. But, you know, there's so many reasons in terms of the overall impact on our health, the environment, the efficiency of land use, etc. You know, vegetables are sort of where it's at. And if we can get people to eat a few more of them, it's going to be a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. And, you know, Dig In is a company that's making it pretty. It's making it accessible, but it's making it pretty as well, because with the new development of your more recent restaurants, I had the pleasure of going to your new restaurant on the Upper East Side. And I used to work in Battery Park City, so I used to dive across. I had 40 minutes to Brookfield Place, try and nip in it before the huge line formed.
Right.
Get my bowl. It was in its, like, the compartmentalized bowl. Stuff it back to work. But now it has, you know, these beautiful bowls, these Wind Noble bowls from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And it gives it much more of that restaurant feel. It doesn't, no longer feels like a fast casual. It feels like you're getting a full dining experience, even though you are approaching a production line where the food is being served.
Yeah. It's just part of the evolution, right? You know, taking the food that's grown responsibly and taken care of, and then moving into the restaurants, and then prepping it properly, and then taking care of as you cook it with the cooks and chefs in our restaurants, all the way to how you serve it, right? How you present it. It's doing what we can to celebrate, you know, sort of the value and the quality of the food. And as we've grown and evolved, and we went from a couple of units to many more now, and hopefully with some luck, many more to come, there are things that we've learned about our business in terms of the way we used to run it that we can no longer afford to do. And so one of those things is when you have just a number of restaurants in one city, and, you know, whether it's myself or some of my colleagues, you can get to every restaurant in a single day, you know. We call it muscling it. You can sort of get by, right? So, you know, you and your small team, everyone's super hungry, and they're out there every day, and we're just working it. We're in the restaurants, we're making it happen. As we grew, and we added more restaurants, we were having a lot of trouble, a lot of challenges with the consistency of the food, how recipes were being prepared, you know, all these things. So we went from a model where we had a general manager, and we had a kitchen manager that looked after the kitchen and cooked the recipes, and a team of cooks, you know, to this acknowledgement that we needed a lot more culinary sophistication inside of the restaurants if we were really going to grow our business successfully, right? That I wasn't going to be at a restaurant every day, nor would my colleagues be. And so what kind of culture do we need to develop and promote beyond being this sort of small group of restaurants, such that everyone in the restaurants would come to work every day taking the food, right, as seriously as we had been taking it when we were in the restaurants every day? So that's been a real evolution for us in terms of really bringing real talented full-service chefs into our restaurants, and really getting everybody to focus and care for and sort of join the organization under the sort of auspices of, if I come here, I'm going to learn about food, I'm going to work with food, I have the opportunity to develop the skills to become a real chef, you know, to run my own restaurant one day. And so these are things where they weren't necessarily top of mind for us because I don't have a culinary background, right? But you learn food, it's not rocket science, and then you're there every day to make it happen. And when that started to happen, we saw that the cracks, you know, in the floor started to emerge, and that we needed to evolve. And so with that evolved approach to our staffing and to our restaurants and to the folks that are running it, you know, that also sort of brought this sort of commitment to, well, look, this is how much care that we're taking for the food. These are the types of folks that are joining our company that want to work in our restaurants. You know, there's this sort of restaurant culture that feels a bit separate and distinct from fast casual or fast food, right? That fast food and fast casual started to feel too transactional to us, right? It was like becoming this jargon, and it was just a new way of doing fast food, but you were still pumping people through. And so this all sort of came to a head where we took a step back and said, look, do we want to be in the transactions business, or do we want to be in the experience business? You know, do we want to deliver an exceptional food experience and a great hospitality experience in a beautiful bowl, you know, in a really, really lovely setting, you know, with some great music playing? Or do we just want to pump people in and out? And for us, culturally, given how we evolved and where we come from and who joined the company and what our collective values represented, we've chosen the latter, which is we want to be in the business of delivering great experiences as opposed to just transactions.
Yeah, as a customer, I can say I'm delighted to see that, because I love the food in the first place, but to go in and sit down and enjoy a meal and look through a menu that's like a magazine, and just really chill out and enjoy the space, it was a pleasure, an absolute pleasure going up there to the Upper East Side. I really liked it. One thing I want to talk about, because this is a split episode between you as the first and Jamie Bissonnette in the next episode as a restaurateur, and with the focus on you, it's a far more expansive operation.
Yeah.
How did you find it? You know, I'm sure you've learned so much over the years since you started in 2007, but what are some of the key things that you've learned as a restaurateur over these years? Because despite being the CEO of the company, essentially you are a restaurateur as well.
For sure. It's a pretty long list, and you know, the last decade has been riddled with mistakes, you know. So, you know, first to acknowledge that. Top of the list for me, less is more, you know. Keep it simple, stupid, KISS, KISS, right? These aphorisms that exist.
Yeah, but what do you mean by that? Because we hear that all the time.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't really buying it for a while, and so I had to really learn for myself, because for better or for worse, I'm fairly ambitious, and you know, I feel like I've always felt like it's just food. You know, we're not trying to put a man on the moon here. So if we want to do X, we want to do Y, we want to try A, we want to try B, we can do that. You know, I've had a pretty lengthy education in the restaurant business as a restaurateur. I've had a pretty lengthy education in understanding the consumer, right, and how the consumer makes choices every day, and why do they go to certain places for certain things, and why do they go to other places for other things. And then as we've scaled our business, and as I talked about earlier, you know, we started to see things that were starting to break, right? You know, that's when we realized that the complexity that we had created needed to be addressed in order for us to really be successful in achieving our mission, which was, if we wanted to be a small 10 or 15 restaurant local business, we could do that and it could make money and it could be fine as a business, but it wouldn't really have an impact, right? For us to really have an impact, we really want to, we want something significant. And entertaining the idea of scale changes things pretty significantly, right? You can have complexity in one location, particularly if you're there every day, right? But as soon as you start thinking about a much larger business, a decentralized business, where you have restaurants in different cities or even different countries, that's a different matter. So we're currently, and we'll probably for the next couple of years, continue to be in the process of identifying opportunities to reduce complexity. Our model in general is as complex as it comes for our business, right? We've chosen the hardest way to do supply, right? A lot of other folks, they have one distributor, folks show up, they bring everything to them, you know, and then they come back the next day. So supply, we have a lot of resources, you know, on this team that other companies don't need to have, you know, to manage that process. And then we make everything from scratch every day, right? And we serve hot food, mostly vegetables that perish, you know, within a half hour. So on both ends, we've made the job pretty hard for ourselves. So we're looking at it now. We've been looking at it and saying, what are all maybe the more frivolous things that we are doing or have done or that aren't maybe necessarily at our core, you know, that we can strip out, you know, so that we're ultimately making the job of, we call them chef operators or chef operators or our chef de cuisines or our lead sous, we can make their job of coming to work every day when 9 million things happen. People call out, the delivery's late, the ice machine breaks, what, you know, it rains, it snows, you know, making their jobs easier so that when they're coming to work every day, you know, they have the most or the highest probability of success. So I'd say that's one, and that's still a lesson that I'm learning, but not a lesson to be dismissed by others that are thinking about embarking on this journey.
Okay? That's an extensive one.
I'd say the second, which goes part and parcel, is you know, everybody always talks about how it's all about the people, and you always hear, no matter what industry agnostic, it's all about the people. For our business, it couldn't be more true, right? 15 restaurants, 500 something people. And, you know, it's like a dance every day. You know, for us to staff a shift during, you know, peak lunch, we need 15 or 18 people, right? Two of those people call out, everything goes up in flames. Read a book, I know, within the last year by an MIT professor called The Good Job Strategy. And it's a really eye-opening read and really has changed the course for us. You know, we've been identifying and understanding the value and the importance of taking care of our people over the years, but probably not in such a focused way as we do now, and we'll continue going forward. Having read this book, it talks about how so many companies say they want to be a people-forward company, or they want to take care of their people, or they want to make the people the most important priority. Very few people actually have the willingness to do what it takes. And so it's focused on retail specifically, and it cites a couple of different businesses that have been particularly successful, one of which is an example is Costco, you know, what they've been able to do with their business. And so our business strategy going forward in terms of how we think we can develop a competitive advantage, given the high-touch nature of our business every day, where you're preparing and serving fresh food from scratch and interacting with every guest, is in a number of ways, we want to be the place where everybody wants to come to work. You know, there's compensation components to that. There's training, development, and growth opportunities. There's quality of life. There's a lot of different things that go into that, but we're spending a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of resources thinking about how we can differentiate ourselves in that regard. You know, because we know every time we have an unhappy person in one of our restaurants, it has a domino effect. You know, the entire day, the entire restaurant, all of our guests. But those restaurants that are really humming, that have a great culture, you know, our chef operators are taking care of their people. You know, they're doing celebrations, they're doing parties. You know, we're doing fireside chats where we bring them up into the office and we do a 2-hour feedback session. What's going on? What's in your mind? What's working? What's not? All of those things are, you know, they pay themselves back in spades. So I sort of, I guess at a point in time, I didn't scoff at it, but it always felt like, oh, I'll get to that, right? But there's so many other things we need to figure out, you know. Right. You know, going back, if I were to do it all over again, I wish I started with that, you know. And then I think a lot of the other things that I was looking to tend to over the years would have never even made it to my plate, you know, because if we sort of took care of the core issue at the time, which was just figure out how to get them to be happy and motivated every day, it may have been a bit smoother of a ride.
Well, being a restaurateur is always a learning curve.
It sure is.
So I've loved this interview, loved this chat, but as always, we're going to finish with the most important question. What has the food industry given you since you got into it?
Yeah, that one's easy. So I've been with my wife for 9 years now. So she met me just as I was starting, you know, on this journey. And what she would tell you is, had she met me a few years prior, we wouldn't have likely ended up together. So, you know, you use the word humility later. There's something about this business, particularly, you know, the way we've gone through it in our journey, that really humbles you, you know, that really takes you down a few pegs. It connects you in a way to just, like, the world and provides you a perspective that I think when we live in our little sort of bubbles, particularly in places like the Northeast or in Manhattan, that we don't really think of or step outside of. But, you know, how the rest of the world operates, you know, what it's like to get on your hands and knees and pull asparagus out of the ground every day, you know, like, I know a lot of our team members that have been with us for years and years and years now, I've gotten to know a lot of them really well. And, you know, different circumstances, different situations. Some of those folks are making $12 or $13 an hour. Some of them started out as dish pit folks. Now they're making $75, $80, $90,000 a year. But, you know, the relationships that I've made and lessons I've learned from everybody that's either in terms of this business, you know, our guests, you know, they're walking through every day, or all the different people we partner with, those collective experiences have, like, profoundly changed me as a person. And nothing to do with the financial services industry, but I fear, had I just stayed on that track and just done that for the rest of my life, that I wouldn't have had the opportunity, you know, to learn a lot of the things that I have over this last decade. And I don't know if I'd be such a sweet person. So not that I am, but I'm still working on it.
Well, I've heard pretty good stuff about you.
But,
so I think you're all right.
You know, it's given me a lot, and I feel really grateful for that, because I didn't know that was what I was signing up for. I thought, great business opportunity, personally love the mission, love living this way, but this was sort of one of those little ancillary byproducts or benefits that's been, you know, pretty tremendous.
Great. Well, thank you from me. Thanks for having Dig In.
Thank
I'm
you.
A proud customer of it. I want to say thanks to Ali Weltman for putting all of this together. It's been a challenge, but I'm delighted that we've been able to host the interview here in the Dig In HQ and look out on such a beautiful view and have a chance to chat to you today. So thanks, Adam.
Right on. It's been a pleasure.
I also want to say thanks to Heritage Radio for giving the show a platform and 34 other shows as well to have such amazing conversations and give access to so many amazing topics on a weekly basis. If it wasn't for them, this wouldn't be happening right now. So if you want to check out more interviews, you can do so at heritageradionetwork.org. I also want to thank David Tadashore for producing today's show. If you want to get in touch, please do so by emailing me at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can get me on social media through Why Food Podcast. Next week will be part two of the Restaurateur episode, where I'll be interviewing Jamie Bissonnette, who is the head chef and founder of Toro NYC and Toro Boston and Copa in Boston. Thanks very much for tuning in, guys. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.